The date is December 5th, 1984, and we're watching Beverly Hills Cop. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Sergeant Taggart to my Detective Rosewood.
Hello, I'm Colin Stewart.
So this week, we are looking back at December 1984 when the movies in theaters were Oh God, You Devil, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Ninja Busters, I don't know, I Ain't Afraid of No Ninja, I think is the tagline for that one.
That seems like, is that, that doesn't even seem like a movie that can be in the alphabet. Like, you're going into, like, that's like a double A movie, like, so far gone, so far out of the studio system that it just...
And, well, yeah, if it wasn't 1984, I'd say that it was, like, shot on a cell phone.
Yeah.
Supergirl, the movie, and, of course, our movie for today, Beverly Hills Cop, which earned $316.3 million on a $13 million budget, making it the second highest grossing movie of 1984 behind Temple of Doom, and Ghostbusters is a close third. Ninja Busters and Ghostbusters were competing in the same year.
I was going to say, with a lineup like that, like, you have Nightmare on Elm Street, I guess. But, you know, to me, like, nowadays, anyways, I don't know if it was like this in 1984, but, like, December is like, big movie month. Yeah. Like, there's, you know, you have the blockbuster month in, like, you know, like, late June to August. And then you have, like, December when kind of all, like, it's like the second blockbuster month around like Christmas time and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But with that lineup, I don't know, like, where does, I'm kind of wondering, I guess, where 1984 ranks in the pantheon of like movie years. Like, is it, it's clearly not like 1999.
Well,
but is it as bad as like, I don't know. No,
1984 is a solid year. I was actually looking at it earlier. Because we have Gremlins and Footloose and Police Academy and 16 Candles, Karate Kid, Ghostbusters, The Last Starfighter, like all these movies that we've already watched, The Terminator, these are all 1984 movies. The thing that I'm surprised by is usually when I do the in the theaters at the same time, I usually don't go more than a month back from the actual release date. Which tells me that A Nightmare on Elm Street was released post-Halloween. Like, that's also the unusual thing, is that Nightmare on Elm Street was a mid-November, early December release. It was somewhere in that window. I don't remember exactly.
That is... Yeah, I would have pegged that for a Halloween movie for sure.
Yeah.
But anyways, as usual, there will be spoilers ahead, so if you don't want this movie to be spoiled for you, then please hit pause, go watch it, and then come back and hear what we have to say.
That's right, because the heat is on over here.
Yeah, the heat is definitely on.
So I found three taglines for this poster that for this movie. The first, which was only on Australian release posters, in Detroit, a cop learns to take the heat. In L.A., he learns to keep his cool.
Okay.
I mean,
that's like really telling the Australians, like, let me explain America to you in a tagline.
Yeah. Should I have done that in an Australian accent? Should I have been like, crikey, in Detroit?
Oh, I'll drive.
The second tagline, he's been chased, thrown through a window, and arrested. Eddie Murphy is a Detroit cop on vacation in Beverly Hills.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Well, that tells you what's happening.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like, that's your summary right there. Well, number three, the heat is on.
It's on the street.
You want that second part of the tagline, absolutely. But
If there was a way, to put music into a tagline, they should have used that one. Like, I never realized it. I think only because as I watched the movie, it reoccurred so often that I was kind of like, oh yeah, this happens. This same tune happens in a lot of movies, but it's that.
Axel F. Yeah.
Is that an actual song,
yeah,
or is that
it's Axel F is what it's called, and it's his theme song.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's in so many other movies. Well, I feel like, or am I just imagining that?
Maybe
in my mind?
Something similar as well. I mean, I think people pull it out every once in a while, but yeah, it's his theme song. It's just like do 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 do. Yeah. Right. I mean, everyone knows. So.
Every time I hear that song, it just. Like the thing that it elicits is, and because I'd never seen this movie, as we'll discuss later, but like, I mean, that song, the moment I hear it, all I'm thinking about is people on some sort of clandestine stakeout, like ducking under buildings and like looking around to see if there's somebody nearby or like that type of thing.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Now I know where it came from.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the Mission Impossible theme gets thrown in every once in a while. Like, we saw that one in Ace Ventura.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Axel F. theme is a song by Harold Faltmeyer. So, I just looked that up. And one of my choices on Google is Axel F. lyrics. I'm going to click on that. But first, let's go to Colin for a 60-second synopsis.
After his sting operation goes south and leads to a dangerous police chase through the city, young, brash, fast-talking Detroit police officer Axel Foley is at risk of losing his badge. Fortunately, his childhood friend has come to pay him a visit fresh out of prison. Unfortunately, only scenes later after a night of partying, that friend is shot and killed by some former associates from California. Axel decides to launch a cross-jurisdictional investigation and heads to Beverly Hills, where he quickly begins to butt heads with the local police force and high society bigwig Victor Maitland, his buddy's former boss and the prime suspect in his murder. As Axel works to gather evidence against Maitland, he develops a relationship with the two cops assigned to keep an eye on him and ensure he doesn't get into any trouble on his vacation. And that's, I'm going to sum that up as our 60-second synopsis, because the rest of the movie is pretty much just him, you know, like searching buildings, repeatedly going to this art store to confront Maitland and getting thrown out in a variety of ways and playing pranks on the two police officers until eventually, as all buddy cop or semi like comedy police-esque movies result, there's a massive shootout in the end where instead of bringing the bad guy to justice, they just kill him instead. And, you know, nobody gets charged on murder. This movie actually ends in a pretty shady police cover-up that would, like, make anybody from today's world cringe, but that's okay. It worked in the 1980s.
Right on. So, it's Crazy Frog. That's why there's lyrics.
Oh, Crazy Frog?
Yeah.
What's going on?
So those are the lyrics are just, they're gibberish in this song.
Okay.
Yeah. Ridiculous. Yeah, so the Beverly Hills Cop trilogy is one that I love. I've always loved Beverly Hills Cop. But the second one is more fun. And then the third one is kind of dumb. Right, okay. So it's kind of like they found their sweet spot in the middle, right? This one, I mean, it's not as funny as the second one, but it's not as off the walls as the third one. Yeah, it's tough to explain, but I've always loved this series. I mean, I'm an Eddie Murphy fan, and this is when Eddie Murphy was at his best. So you alluded to it earlier. Well, you actually flat out just said it. You haven't seen this movie before.
No, I've never seen Beverly Hills Cop. Obviously, like I've heard of it, but I think we talked about this when we talked about Coming to America. Like, I don't know that I've seen any Eddie Murphy movie other than the ones that I've watched for this And Shrek. Shrek was the one we talked. I've seen Shrek, but other than that, I don't think I've seen.
No Nutty Professor or no Nutty Haunted Mansion or.
No, none of that.
No, okay.
And so, yeah, it's always interesting to me to come back, or well, not come back, but go and watch an Eddie Murphy movie because, you know, obviously he's someone people speak very highly of. And that sort of thing. But, I mean, it's funny in Beverly Hills Cop, like, there's other movies I have seen, like Rush Hour, where you can kind of see, now going back, you can see, like, oh, the influence of that movie on this movie.
Totally. Well, alrighty, let's just get into it. Let's jump into Beverly Hills Cop, directed by Martin Brest, who's the director of, like, Scent of a Woman and Midnight Run, Meet Joe Black. But his last directorial effort was Geely. So the Beverly Hills Cop guy did Geely,
and then he just was unhirable probably after that.
Yeah, probably. I think he does. If I remember correctly, he does a lot of writing and producing. So he's not unemployed. It's produced by Jerry Bruckheimer and Don Simpson, and it's written by Daniel Petrie Jr., who gets the screenplay story by credit, and Danilo Bach, who gets the story by credit. So this movie was originally supposed to be like a Sylvester Stallone movie where Mickey would have been his brother and Jenny was his love interest. So I'm going to let you wrap your head around that for a second.
I'm assuming it wasn't going to be a comedy.
Probably not.
I just kidding. Like, to me, that's like when you mention it, I'm like, oh yeah, I could see the bones of a Stallone movie. Yeah. But if you put Stallone in it, it's going to be a lot more, like, brooding, revenge. Yeah, like, kind of a revenge Punisher-esque movie, I think. I think instead of going and trying to find the drugs and all that and doing an actual investigation, it would have just been Stallone killing off the henchmen one by one.
It's Liam Neeson and Taken is what it is.
Yeah, basically, something like that.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I wonder if it was the same script. If it was the same script. That also makes me wonder how much of the movie Eddie Murphy improvised.
Most of what he says is improvised.
Okay.
Including the scene where he's trying to get into the hotel and starts dropping the N-bomb, hurling that around. And, you know, the director wasn't sure whether he should keep it in. And he's like, no, I said it. Keep it in. Now, Axel Foley, they were all over the place with Axel Foley. I mean, we could, like, go down the list here. Let's do the alternate castings in no particular order except alphabetical. It's the usual list. Jeff Bridges, James Caan, Billy Crystal, Robert De Niro, Harrison Ford, Richard Gere, Mel Gibson, Gregory Hines, Michael Keaton, Nick Nolte, Al Pacino, Richard Pryor, Dennis Quaid, Mickey Rourke, Kurt Russell, Arnold Schwarzenegger, John Travolta, Robin Williams, and Bruce Willis. Those are the possible alternate castings for Axel Foley. So they really didn't know what kind of movie they wanted.
I mean, clearly they wanted a movie with a white guy, though.
Yeah, we've got Gregory Hines and Richard Pryor on the list. Richard Pryor, I think, would have given you the same sort of movie.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, like, with that casting, though, to imagine what this movie would have been like. Like, I honestly can't imagine this movie without Eddie Murphy, even though I don't really have any knowledge to base that on, but it just seems like he so well inhabits the role. And just the general tone of the movie that I can't imagine. All those other guys that you listed, you know, maybe Bruce Willis.
Maybe Billy Crystal. Like, this is Billy Crystal in 84, so this is young Billy Crystal.
But Billy Crystal doesn't have the physical competence. Like, Billy Crystal to me would almost be some sort of, like, 1984 version of Johnny English.
Hey, Billy Crystal was drafted by the New York Yankees, you know.
I did not know that. He has
officially done one at-bat for the New York Yankees. It was, like, some big publicity stunt, but he was officially on the team. Yeah. Huh. So he has physical prowess. What I'm looking at when I think of Billy Crystal is the impressions that Billy Crystal does, because Eddie Murphy drops into a lot of different characters in this movie, depending on his circumstance. So that's where I get the Billy Crystal vibe. That's all I mean by that.
It kind of makes it, yeah. I'm just, the alternate castings and the ideas of, like, who, like, even with Stallone and all that, really are kind of just driving home the idea to me that the end result of what this movie is, I don't think was the original intention. It doesn't, no. I can't imagine it was.
No, it's not the same movie. There's no way. And with Jerry Bruckheimer behind it, you know that it's not the same movie. I mean, we talked about that in Bad Boys, where we found out that was supposed to be, what, like a Rob Schneider and Chris Farley movie or some shit like that?
Yeah.
You know, something ridiculous.
Yeah, it's almost like, it's almost the opposite scenario of this one, but yeah. Interesting.
That's true. So we open this movie with, like, the soundscape of just city noises slowly coming in, and then the heat is on, just hits us hard. This is a great music movie. Like, it's what a solid soundtrack this movie has.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you like 80s movies, or 80s music.
Yeah. I don't think The Heat is On is the perfect song for a cop movie of any type.
Yeah.
I think it does well to set the tone of a cop movie. I have to admit that I was very thrown off by this opening, because when I read the title Beverly Hills Cop, I assumed I was immediately thrown off by, like, okay, how does this get to Beverly Hills?
Yeah.
Why is it in Detroit? And I also feel like this speaks to there's a whole, obviously, like, kind of East-West thing that may be happening here that I don't think translates as much in today's world.
Yeah, especially to a Canadian.
Yeah, and especially to a Canadian. But I was wondering about that too. Like, but at the same time, I don't. Maybe he does, but I don't know. I don't get, like, the Detroit sense of Eddie Murphy. Like, I don't. He doesn't strike me as Detroit.
Yeah, you were wondering whether his name was, like, going to be Johnny Beverly Hills or something. Oh, that's why he's the Beverly Hills Cop. Okay.
Well, it's made even more confusing knowing that there's two sequels, to be like, okay, like, what is the reason? Like, what is the reason that he keeps going back to Beverly Hills?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, how does John McClane always end up in the right place at the wrong time, you know?
I guess that's true.
I definitely enjoy the 80s of it all, though, with this opening bit where they're just showing all the shots of people in, like, their Michael Jackson-style vests, you know, their thriller vests and everything. But we get to see our man Eddie Murphy, Axel Foley, selling cigarettes to some shady guys. We never do hear what their name is, but I'm guessing, I don't know, Vinny and Tony?
Something like that. Something Italian.
It's got to be, right? Yeah. Okay. But I love the way that this is shot, with them arguing in the back of the truck, and you can see the cop car slowly drive by in the background and then back up. I thought it was well filmed there.
That scene, I mean, I don't want to spend the whole episode comparing this movie to Rush Hour, but I was struck by, like, how Rush Hour basically just ripped this off.
Yeah.
Like, the opening of Rush Hour is almost the exact same, not obviously it's different types of stuff, but it's the same premise.
Yeah.
Like, Chris Tucker is trying to do a sting operation. Well, the police show up and screw it up, and then there's mayhem.
Yeah, like, I mean, I think Lethal Weapon would be another strong contender to compare it to as well. Like, even though he doesn't really have the buddy cop, he kind of gets two buddies that equal one buddy, is kind of how this one works out. But when it comes to Rush Hour and Lethal Weapon, I think both of those series have some sort of truck chase, just like the opening of this one. Like, doesn't one of the Rush Hours have Jackie Chan hanging off the back of a moving semi in one of the sequels?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I don't know which one.
Okay, yeah. But yeah, I mean, they take off on that truck chase with the Pointer Sisters Neutron Dance going. I mean, come on. So 80s. But I also love these cars with the old school cop cars with the giant fucking bubbles on the roof, the huge sirens. Oh, those were awesome.
Yeah, the car, I like the scene. I like that whole scene when he shows up. The fact that he's, like, It was also weird to just kind of see a truck full of cigarettes. I'm like, oh yeah, people still smoked that much back then, that would be a thing.
Yeah, on the black
market. But I mean, it's also, I think, like, I was kind of just struck by, like, oh yeah, Eddie Murphy is an actor. Like, I'm not used to him. Like, I only ever think of him as, like, Donkey, basically. that every time I actually see him performing in the flesh, I'm like, oh yeah, okay. Like, he's actually pretty good. He's a very believable, like, charismatic guy.
Yeah. But then he also turned into the guy that likes to do 100 characters in his movies, like Mike Myers.
Yeah, and I think that's, to me, that's part of the reason why I kind of missed out on him. Like, I think I looked at Nutty Professor and all of that, and I was like, ah, I'm not really interested in that, and kind of just, like, wrote him off.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, Eddie Murphy in the 80s and 90s was a much different Eddie Murphy. And, mm-hmm. I mean, because I watched all his Saturday Night Live stuff, and, I mean, there's even the little cheeky wink and the nod to the camera in this movie where when he gets to Beverly Hills, he walks by the two guys that are dressed in the leather jumpsuits, which are the same jumpsuits that he wore in his Raw and his Delirious stand-up specials.
I didn't pick up on that. I thought he was laughing at them because I thought the one guy in the red jumpsuit, just before he was talking about Michael Jackson at the hotel concierge, and I thought that jumpsuit was like the Thriller jumpsuit.
Oh, okay. No, yeah, that was what he wore in Delirious. Or I don't remember which one. I think Raw is the red suit. Delirious is the purple, I think. Ah, I don't know. But they're the ugliest suits ever. I also totally forgot that Paul Reiser was in this movie. He gets like one scene, but yeah, I forgot that Paul Reiser was part of this franchise.
I mean, I always think of Paul Reiser as being a somebody. I thought it was weird that he's kind of just this, like, background character.
Yeah, no, that's kind of who he is. I mean, he was in, like, Aliens, and he was the background character in Aliens. Like, he was the annoying guy from corporate or whatever. You know, okay. I mean, Mad About You was kind of his big thing, I think.
Okay.
Other than that, he's always sidekick characters.
That's all I really know him from, so I just thought that maybe he was a big shot. Yeah. But I guess he was kind of like pre-Friends, where like being on a sitcom was a vehicle to like movie fame and fortune.
Well, and this is also several years before Mad About You.
Yeah.
So too. I love how the captain, though, in this precinct, you see where the stereotype of yelling captains has begun. Anytime anyone spoofs that in anything, it's this captain right here, his Detroit inspector, whatever his name was.
Yeah, he's very reminiscent of the captain from Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
the one that April keeps pissing off.
Mm-hmm. Lorenzo and Die Hard 2, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are things like it would be interesting to go back in time. Maybe you're right, like if this is the genesis of that trope or not, because it's become such a big thing.
Yeah.
Going forward.
But I also like how different the cops in Beverly Hills are, though. He's not a yeller in Beverly Hills.
Yeah. I mean, in Beverly Hills, the cop is kind of like, you mean you're talking not the, are you he talking is, about like the, I don't remember their ranks, but the you have like in Beverly,
yeah.
Okay, like the one who like kind of covers for him?
Or it's Lieutenant Bogomil. And he's the guy that's like, do you want to press charges against Sergeant Taggart?
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, but they have, I think it's still like the chief.
The really old man that comes in.
Yeah, but I would still agree with you. Like, he's not a yeller.
Yeah.
But he's very, like, he still has that kind of gravitas. Like, he's very stern and very, like, I will wreck you and ruin your career type thing. But he's not the, like, give me your gun and your badge type, police chief.
Yeah, exactly.
I find it odd that when he gets to California, they keep talking about, like, escorting him to the city limits.
Yeah.
Because I just feel like my recollection of being in Los Angeles is that it's just, like, a massive amount of suburbs. So, like, what constitutes the city limits?
Yeah, it's sprawling.
Like, I don't know where one city ends and one city begins.
Well, and exactly. Is it kind of like, okay, as soon as you're in Pasadena, you're out of LA? Like, or I don't even know if that's one of the ones right next to it, but...
Yeah.
So, oh, okay, so when he gets home from work and he parks his car and it starts rolling backwards, do you think that was a blooper? or do you think that was actually in the script?
I'm going to go blooper.
Yeah.
Because the character is not like a dumb guy. And he's not even like the type of like down on your luck.
Well, I think it's just the fact that it's a shitty car is the point. If it's not a blooper, that's the point of it. But I feel like the way that he's trying to stop the car by like hopping backwards with the door open, I'm like, that's a dangerous stunt for him to be doing on that incline. Like, really? The insurance signed off on this one?
I'm gonna do a quick Google. Maybe I can.
But yeah, he gets home in his car, but he finds that his buddy has shown up. What was his buddy Mickey shows up, and it does get me like wondering like a bit about Axel's backstory. Like, oh, who was this guy before he was a cop? You know, they only tease a little bit of it.
Yeah, because they have that whole conversation about like, you know, Mickey didn't tell the cops that he was there. You get a lot of weird male vulnerability for 1984, I feel like, in this movie.
True.
Which is, you know, kind of refreshing to see.
That's true, yeah.
But also very weird to see for a movie this old. But, yeah, I kind of wondered, like, how is it that Axel even ends up being a police officer or wants to be a police officer? Like, it sounds like it almost sounds like he comes from a life of petty crime. Yeah.
So like, doesn't he even say at one point, like, doesn't he hotwire a car with Jenny at one point? And he's just like, you know, says something about his time boosting cars or something. Or am I thinking of something else I watched this week? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Maybe it's because I watched The Terminator recently, too. And they're always boosting cars in that one.
I can't confirm that car situation is a blooper.
No? Okay.
No. But yeah, you have Michael come show up or not? Is it Michael or is it Mickey?
Mickey. Well, I think it's Michael, but he calls him Mickey.
Okay.
Yeah, Michael Tendino.
It's a weird way to kind of I don't know what they call it, the inciting incident of the story.
Yeah.
To have this guy randomly just show up with these German bond papers. And then I thought it was odd that when Maitland's henchmen show up, if you were going to kill Mickey, this was kind of a big plot error for me. I don't understand why they wouldn't have killed Axel, why they would have just settled for knocking him out.
Yeah.
You got to imagine that really gnaws on that guy afterwards when Axel becomes such a pain.
Right?
Ass.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, it's kind of like, well, you only hired me to kill this guy, so I'm not going
to. It was like that was his rate.
Yeah, you know, like, no, it's time to take my time card over to the punch clock. I'm done. I did my one kill, and actually, it's really weird because. I guess they forgot to film one of the shots, which is why he just kind of disappears, like where you don't really see what actually happens to him. Like they hit him, and then that's the last you see of him, right?
Okay, I'm glad you said that because I was wondering. I'm not like I was watching the movie, and I kind of missed what happened to Axel.
Yeah,
and so in my mind, because like you said, the scene goes on, and he's not there.
Yeah.
Like, continuity-wise, he's not there anymore. So I had thought that, like, Axel just left.
Yeah.
And was like, oh, I need to go grab something. And Mickey was just waiting for him and all this stuff happened. But then after he gets shot, then magically, like, you see Axel, like, is still knocked out in the doorway as the two guys leave.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, he got knocked out. But now that you say that makes a lot of sense. I was very confused for a minute.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't spend the money and do a reshoot, you know, just take a camera over to his house, put him up against a blank wall and, you know, just show him slumping down the wall. Like, should do something. Yeah. But yeah, it's we get to see Mike from Breaking Bad again.
Yeah. It's kind of weird seeing what's his name?
Jonathan Banks.
Jonathan Banks, like all I knew him from previously was Breaking Bad, and now I think he's been in two of the more recent movies that we watched, and I'm like, oh yeah, this.
Yeah, because he was in Buckaroo Banzai.
This guy had a whole career.
But always as a tough guy. But yeah. I find it funny though, because like I saw him and I'm like, oh, like, you know, his name's got to be like Polly or something, right? And mm-hmm. and it's Zach. Like, like, I'm sorry, you know, like, no offense to anyone out there named Zach, but you don't really strike fear in my heart if you're Zach. Like, even if you're the Zach Attack, I mean, that's not a good wrestler name. I wouldn't be afraid of the Zach Attack.
Well, I mean, there is Zach Ryder, Long Island IZ, but
yeah,
but that gimmick worked for other reasons. But yeah, you're right. Zach is not like
Zach like, is Zach Morris from Saved by the Bell.
You don't ever get any like crime boss picking up the phone and be like, "Get me Zach on the line." Like,
yeah. But yeah, so he sobers up pretty quick though. Like when he gets attacked, like the Mickey, he sobers up really quick before he gets dead, you know.
Yeah.
Cuz they were piss drunk.
Yeah, that's true. I never noticed that till you mention it.
Yeah.
I wasn't really expecting them to kill him. Jonathan Banks, for all his, I mean, you can tell he's a pro. He's a pro as acting at a henchman, because he really made me believe like he was just going to rough him up a little bit.
Yeah. The murder, though, it gets him to gets Axel to decide to take some vacation time, and he decides to go spend it in L.A., where he is constantly told not to go anywhere near the case. Oh, no, he's just going on vacation. So everything he does is a hustle. Like, what was his plan for the hotel room? Because, like, $235 a night, I converted that, and it's $650 a night in today's money. So, like, you know, was he planning on stiffing them or what? Like, or did he just put on the act to get a room and he decided that was the room he wanted? Was he willing to spend that much?
Yeah, that's true, because it does all work out in the end.
Yeah.
But... yeah, there isn't any, like, forced thought, or, like, it would have been funnier if they, like, showed him, like, stealing the Detroit police chief's, like, credit card or something like that, or, like, some sort of something like that, where it would have been,
yeah, like,
it would have made more sense up front, I guess.
Yeah, in the second one, what he does when he comes to L.A. is he finds a house that's under renovation. He walks onto the site like he belongs there, like he's a foreman. And he finds out that the people are out of town while their house is being worked on. And then he pretends as the foreman to fire the entire crew. And then he just hangs out in this mansion in Beverly Hills. So like he scams his way into a house. I mean, this way is a little more illegal, but.
He's got a little bit of Kevin McAllister in him.
A little bit. Yeah. But yeah, I just what was his end game on this hotel room? I just don't know whether he was actually willing to pay. He's lucky that the tab was picked up by the Beverly Hills Police Department.
It's kind of like there are certain things like that where it's story-wise it doesn't make any sense. Like what would have been the harm in him? Like if this was a Stallone casted movie, I guarantee you that Stallone just finds the cheapest motel, has like pins on the wall with string, and broods over it day and night between kills.
Yeah,
but like, yeah. But when
sitting in a dark hotel room with the shades drawn and a glass of whiskey in his hand, you know, just smoking and staring at that yarn map on his wall.
But there are things like, because Eddie Murphy is in the movie, where I feel like they just throw these weird, like, almost SNL type sketches into the movie that have no bearing on the story, but are just there for, like, comedic effect.
Well, and that's all the parts where he's just riffing.
Yeah.
Like, all his little speeches and everything like that, that's just him fucking around as Eddie Murphy. And so, I mean, that's his thing, is he does little characters. And you saw it in Coming to America, where he's five different people. You saw it in, you know, or you see it in The Nutty Professor. You see it in, you know, Saturday Night Live. So it's just, it's his thing. Even in stand-up, he likes putting on voices. And, you know, like, there's, you know, his, "Hello, Eddie." So, because he's always playing a different character in this movie. And it is true. You're right. It's, a lot of it is like a little sketch. Like, like the whole bit with the banana in the tailpipe. Like, that would have been a funny SNL sketch, is sending a breakfast out to the guys in the car that are doing the stakeout.
Yeah. We just don't really know what, like, to go back to your point, it's like, you just, it ends up being a really funny scene. I enjoy it. I enjoy the scene a lot, and I enjoy, like, the whole idea of, you know, I think it's relatable in that, you know, whenever you go to a hotel, it's like everybody, you know, whatever's not bolted down and seems reasonable to take, you take.
I've got a couple towels in my linen closet, yeah.
But it's like, yeah, the more you think about it, the more you're like, well, I guess maybe the thought is like, I am here to do this investigation on who killed my friend, but while I'm here, I might as well have a vacation as well.
I'll indulge, yeah.
Yeah.
Our next scene, though, we get to see Bronson Pinchot. That was another thing that I was surprised about with the 1984 movie, was how this clearly flamboyantly gay character was still handled well. No big deal was made about the fact he was just a character in this 1984 movie, and it's like, oh, right on. Like,
yeah.
It's more of that progressive shit that you were talking about earlier, you know?
Yeah, that's true. He was obviously gay, but there was no jokes at his expense.
Yeah.
And he wasn't like that, like, flamboyant, like, caricature that you often see.
No, absolutely not. And Bronson Pinchot, fuck, I used to watch Perfect Strangers. I love this guy. I mean, he is so funny.
I have no idea who he is.
Oh, well, just some of his deadpan deliveries with, you know, with this character. He is so funny in this part, I thought.
I liked him in the movie, but I had no idea that he was like a somebody, I guess.
I don't think he was so much. Like, Perfect Strangers, much like... Mad About You. Yeah, it didn't come around until like the late 80s, early 90s. So like, he might have gotten the sitcom off of this movie, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, if you won like the Lotto Max $50 million lottery, do you think you would buy a $135,000 table that has spinning heads on it?
No.
Like, are there actually art galleries that sell that kind of art?
I don't know about sell. I mean, I remember I went to, when I was in Europe, I went to the London, I think, I want to say it's like the Tate Museum of Modern Art. And I remember there was like one art installation, I'll call it that, that was just like crows pinned to the wall with arrows and like blood trickling down.
Okay.
And then...
Let me guess, it was called A Murder of Crows.
It might have been, I don't remember.
Oh, it must have been. It had must have to been.
Like 99% it must have been. But then we went, there was another one that was just like, it almost made you feel like you're in Alice in Wonderland or something. Like, it was a giant table and chairs.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if any of this stuff is like, ends up being for sale or anything like that to like, for people, but I imagine there's like some weird, there's for sure some weird art. Oh.
Yeah, I've seen some really weird exhibits at our own art gallery here.
Yeah. And I feel like kind of when you're in that world, like I always laugh. There's a few sketches and shows I've seen do it really well, but it's always like, you know, you could put like a piece of shit on a plate and put it in an art display and there would be somebody who was like, wow, like this just speaks to me. Like,
right?
This,
yeah, I don't get it. I do not get it. I walk around these kind of exhibits and I'm just like, I'll look at them all, but the whole time I'm going, why and what the fuck. And
yeah,
I mean, like his reaction that he has when he finds out that it's $135,000, you know, the get the fuck out of here. No, I will not. Fuck, I love Serge. But yeah, he has to tell Jenny about Mickey being dead. And then when he goes to see the, like, he gets the tip about Vincent. When he goes to that Vincent guy's office, why is he wearing, like, this little kimono robe over his, like, he is at the office, right? He didn't go see him at his apartment.
Right? Yeah. But maybe that's just, I don't know. Maybe that speaks to, like, the California, you know, upper crust fashion.
I mean, is there something I don't know about 1984 West Coast California? You know, like...
Yeah, I feel like I'm reaching here. I have no idea.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, you were getting close to something. I mean, you almost had me in the realm of believing you, so...
Yeah, I wanted to be like, it was, you know, the is like Bohemian Chic was very popular at the time.
Yeah, there we go. That sounds legit.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't know how I feel about Axel's style about just coming out and accusing people of shit.
I know, yeah, that like was the oddest part of this movie to me, because that was kind of the thing that threw off my 60-second synopsis. Yeah. Because... he just shows up, basically walks into, like, the guy who he's pretty sure killed his friend's office.
Yeah.
And accuses him of such, and says, like, and then basically is just like, I know you did it, and I'm going to spend the next week finding out how, or, like, why, and finding the evidence to prove it. But it's like, why would you give up your, like, to quote Obi-Wan, like, he's given up the high ground. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, his element of surprise. This guy does not know that there is a cop from Detroit in town investigating him. He does not know that anything is going on. Like, gather a little bit more intel before you go throwing around accusations.
Yeah, like, you would have thought he would be more subtle and kind of maybe asked him, but like, oh, like, what was Mickey doing for you, or that kind of thing? Like,
yeah, oh, we're trying to hold a memorial, and we're wondering whether you have any pictures of him at work. I don't know, like, you know, come up with something. You have no chill, Axel.
I was also kind of confused because, in like, I feel like the Detroit Police Department would just be assuming this was a Detroit-related thing at this point. Like, it didn't seem to me like they would have any evidence to point to California being involved. So yeah. But then Axel, like, immediately goes, the prime suspect now knows that somebody sees that there's a connection.
Yeah.
And gets... the Beverly Hills police involved. So it's,
well, he's taking point on the investigation, but he's also the only witness.
Yeah.
Like, he is the only one with that has a clue because of where his buddy was hanging out. Like, he's the only person that knows that information.
Yeah, that's a good point too. Like, it's also strange that it doesn't seem like at any time Maitland wants to concern himself with Axel. Like, why isn't he, like, he is the only witness, so you would have thought he would have got on the phone and been like, hey, get me Zach, and then been like, Zach, this guy's on to us, go kill him before anybody else finds out, because then there is no witness, right? There's no credible source.
See, well, after Better Call Saul wraps up, they need to do, like, a Zach many years in the future. I mean, he got killed off. I mean, but, like, I was thinking they could go, like, Picard, like they did with this Star Trek Picard series. You know, have old man Zach. But
it's almost theoretical that...
He's a surfer?
Mike Ehrmantraut could be Zach.
Oh, that's true.
It's just, so, you know, like, I think he did get shot, but, you know, maybe we never see the body. And then years later, he picks up a job as a toll booth worker, and then
isn't he the one that Billy gets right between the eyes? I don't think you're walking away from that one.
Yeah, probably not. I don't know. They could have, they have a lot of advanced, you know, homeopathic medicine in California that
there you go.
The witch doctors and such could have brought him back.
Yeah, absolutely. But so to get Axel out of their office, throwing him through the glass definitely seems excessive. Like, why would you, from a budgetary standpoint, why would you even do that? Like, it's like, fuck, well, that's a $3,000 pane of glass.
Yeah, that didn't seem very well thought out. Well, if I would have been, I would have been pissed.
Possible.
I would have, or possible. Like, I wouldn't have wanted to have to pay for that. Yeah. Yeah, how Axel walks away without a scratch or cut or anything is.
Yeah, and I mean, you gotta call someone to come in and patch that up, and the janitor now has to sweep up all that glass.
Ah. Or maybe it was a trick art window that's like meant to be smashed like daily. Like, it's just a thing. Like, everybody goes through. Somebody goes through it every day. It's an art installation to itself.
That's right. It could be. So, you know, of course, getting yourself thrown through glass gets you arrested. But I love the comment of, you know, this is the cleanest and nicest police car I've ever been inside of. It's great. But we get to meet Sergeant Taggart and Detective Rosewood, or I guess they're both detective sergeants, or I think they're both detective sergeants. I don't know what the ranks mean, but I really enjoy Judge Reinhold. He's funny. See, Judge Reinhold is one of those guys that kind of is a punchline in a lot of things. He's one of those actors, kind of like a Steve Guttenberg type, but I like him in this movie quite a bit.
Yeah, I liked him a lot as well. I wish that if I could go back and remake this movie, I wish that it would have become more of a buddy cop movie with Rosewood and Axel.
Yeah.
Like, I like the bit at the end where, you know, when Rosewood's supposed to take Axel to the city limits again and make sure he's gone for good, and he has, like, his inner battle where he decides to, you know, stay with Axel and ends up getting involved in the shootout and all that.
Yeah.
Like, I would have liked it more if it was kind of like Rosewood ended up being Axel's guy on the inside to aid in his investigation. Like, that would have, it would have been more credible a little bit to me.
Yeah.
And I think they have good chemistry, so I also think it would have been funnier.
Yeah. Well, I also really like the Rosewood Taggart relationship too, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, Taggart's a fun stick in the mud.
Yeah, I mean, but you could have kept all of them. So you could have had it be like the...
Oh, a buddy-buddy-buddy cop movie.
The buddy-buddy-buddy cop movie, yeah. The three-piece meal.
Oh, see, it's like a Three Amigos, but cops.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Maybe that's like a missed opportunity. There isn't a real, three-buddy cop movie I can think of.
Yeah.
Because you always have to have the two people who are from opposite sides of the spectrum, but sometimes maybe it would be nice to just have the person in the middle.
It's usually the bad guys are in a trio.
Yeah.
The people doing shady shit are in a trio, and the cops are buddies.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, you have a movie like Horrible Bosses, you know, there's your trio of bad guys.
But you got a trio of good guys with that one, too. Well, they have their counterparts.
Well... See, I'm thinking the fact that they're plotting a murder makes them bad guys, even though they're the protagonists.
Oh, even though I see, I gotcha.
Yeah. But yes, I forgot. Yes, there's the bad guys, and then there's the worst guys. Yeah. So yeah, they start following Axel around to make sure that he's off the case. We get Damon Wayans in this movie making his debut.
Oh, I didn't know this. He looks so young.
And boy, when he's that young, does he ever look like his son? Holy shit. Because I was a big New Girl watcher, so, I mean, you know, I'm familiar with Damon Wayans Jr.'s. But he's credited as Banana Guy. That's his name in the credits.
I totally forgot that guy from New Girl is his son. There's, like, the one episode where... No, he's Coach, right?
Coach, yeah.
Yeah, there's, like, the one episode I feel like where Coach's dad is there, and it's Damon Wayans, like...
Oh, is it?
But,
oh.
Or no, I'm thinking of the other show he was in, Happy Endings.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he plays his actual dad. He plays his dad on the show.
Yeah.
But they don't look, like, that far different in age.
No. Even now,
like now, I would be like, I would have thought they were more likely brothers than father son.
Yeah, all the Wayans. All the Wayans are like super young looking. I don't think any of them have fallen apart yet.
Yeah. Guess it's black don't crack.
That's right. Yeah, I want to know though, does a banana in the tailpipe actually work? Like, I'm wondering if that's something the Mythbusters have ever covered.
Well, I guess, like, is the theory that it's,
the the exhaust gets backed up, maybe?
Or that, like, does the tailpipe allow the oxygen for, like, combustion to happen?
Yeah, well, see, yeah, that's what I'm thinking. If the exhaust gets backed up, then there's no oxygen for the pistons to...
for the car...
Combustion to happen.
Car machine...
And then I'm wondering whether it's like an old car problem versus a new car problem. Like, is this something that would still be possible? Because, I mean, you're dealing with a 1984 sedan in that movie.
Well, here we go. If you type the words, does banana in, the first result is, does banana in the tailpipe work on Google?
Okay, okay.
And so there's a little line here from... the website www.motorbiscuit.com that says, whether it's meant as a prank or is done with malicious intent, someone stuffing anything into a car's tailpipe could sometimes cause serious damage. And while it's proven that a few bananas won't do the trick, this goes to show we probably shouldn't believe everything we see in the movies.
Well, see, I read somewhere that it was supposed to be a potato in the script. And for some reason, convenience, they used a banana. Like, maybe it's because, like, this fancy place wouldn't have had potatoes sitting out. So they're like, oh, well, we'll just use bananas instead. But it's like, okay, a potato, like, would actually plug it up. Like, a banana, yeah. Stuff can still get around a banana.
Well, I have conflicting information. So on another website called ArsTechnica.com, somebody asks what happens if you put a banana in a tailpipe, and it says it builds up so much back pressure your car will stall. The bananas in the tailpipe block the engine's exhaust. Eventually, the engine is unable to get the exhaust out of the cylinders and replace it with the fresh air and fuel, so the engine stalls. But this says bananas, not just banana. So maybe you need to, like you said, with the potato, like there's people talking about potatoes here too.
Yeah.
You probably need to get like an actual, like a really good blockage.
Well, it's funny because you reading off what that person says would happen sounds like they sat and watched the movie and wrote down what they were witnessing
in the
movie. Like, I mean, because there's definitely a couple other things in this movie that I know aren't real, like coffee grounds being enough to throw off scent dogs for drugs.
Yeah, that probably got a lot of drug dealers busted back in the 80s.
Like, what I've heard for drugs is, like, stuffing it down in the middle of a jar of peanut butter.
Hmm.
But, like, I still wouldn't trust that. I don't want to get my cocaine across the border enough to risk that. I'm not going to be the guinea pig on that. But, yeah, like... And it's such a, like, loose scattering of coffee grounds on top of it. For the size of that crate, I have to assume that that crate is 95% cocaine, or was it heroin? I don't remember. And, you know, like, 5% coffee grounds. It did not look like many coffee grounds.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to keep Googling. I wonder, I'm curious if, like... I also probably shouldn't Google, like, what throws off a drug-sniffing dog on my computer.
No, probably not. Probably not. Yeah, well, welcome to the We'll Google Some Shit For You podcast. Yeah. So, the joke that they play where they give them the glasses with the banana nose, I had those exact glasses when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah?
I was that kid. You know, I was the one that was like, why do I want a regular nose and glasses mustache combo when I can have the funny one with the banana nose? Look at me. I'm fucking hilarious.
That seems like something that you'd probably buy back in the day at what was that store called, like San Francisco?
Oh yeah,
like
yeah.
pre whatever it is now, like Spencer's.
Pre-Spencer's, yeah. Yeah, San Francisco.
I miss those stores. That with store the
dirty
always,
corner.
Yeah, that store always told me like, oh yeah, you're in a mall now.
Yeah. So he puts on another character when he lies his way into the warehouse to check the crate. And I love the moment where he's like, you know, we need to check every crate starting with this one right here. And it's, yeah, that was another great moment, I thought.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's the 1980s or just because they need to give Eddie Murphy funny stuff to do. But for whatever reason, like, I find that nowadays, I'm just like, stuff like that is so impossible that I can't believe it.
Yeah.
Like, in a world without ID cards and scan accesses and the internet and all this stuff, it's like...
Yeah, he's not dressed like anyone else in that building, you know?
I mean, it is kind of a good ploy, I guess, to say like, oh, my business is finding security flaws, because when I worked mall security, there are businesses like that who do that. And I remember we had one come to the mall and basically like test out, like, you know, is it possible to access the mall at night and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I guess it is plausible that way, but.
Yeah, but that's retail. I mean, this is customs. This is
customs.
Like, maybe I'm just looking at it from this side of 9/11. Yeah. Like, is that, you know, like, I just can't imagine that. Yeah. Holy cow.
Yeah, that's fair.
So Axel ends up taking Rosewood and Taggart to the Peeler Bar, but they end up making a bust. Like, you know, like, What shitty timing for those crooks. Like, they were probably sitting at home all day planning it. They're like, yeah, tonight we're going to go to titties, and we're just going to bust in with our shotguns. And I mean, who would know that there would be three cops sitting there, right up in Pervert Row, right up at the front.
Yeah. You probably don't expect to see police officers at a, especially not on-duty police officers at a strip club.
Yeah.
I wouldn't think. You would kind of have expected the California police officers, at least in my opinion, based on TV that I've watched, to be kind of like highfalutin, narcissistic. You know what I'm talking about? Like, I'm just thinking like, you know, in the Mighty Ducks 2, when Gordon Bombay gets his like sponsorship deal and he becomes all like, and he goes to California and becomes this like high class citizen and starts treating everybody like shit. Like, I kind of imagine
corporate. Yeah.
I kind of imagine that's how like California police officers would be in comparison to the Detroit police officers, who seem a little bit more blue collar, a little bit more rough around the edges and that kind of stuff. But
they're still driving around in the cars with the big fucking red bubbles on top.
Yeah, but like Rosewood and Taggart just seem so down to earth.
Yeah.
Just kind of like, yeah, like they're just trying to do their best job. They're just trying to do a good job.
Yeah. Well, like, that's the thing, is they did such a great job in this movie with the LA characters to make them be so opposite of him. But yet, at the same time, they have so much empathy for him, as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they are good cops at the core, even if they seem like idiots to begin with.
Yeah.
But, you know, he has outsmarted Taggart and Rosewood too many times. And so they get pulled off of Axel duty, and now Foster and McCabe have to watch him. I like how he tries to pull the exact same shit with them, though. But he ends up going to the club with to confront Victor again. Like you said, yeah, it's just all these little skits, and so here we go with another confronting Victor skit. But I do like when he pulls up to the club and the valet takes his car and he's like, yeah, park it somewhere nice, all this shit happened last time I was here.
it is kind of surprising that, you know, he manages to like score this sweet hotel room, but he never managed, like, he you would have thought maybe he could have got a nice rental car or something to go with it.
Yeah, but yeah, this is the Harrow Club that he's arrived at, though, And mentioning the Harrow Club, even though it's fictional, I think I'm going to go to Sponsorship Corner. Because I'm running long, holy shit. So always on the lookout for product placements and movies, this week Beverly Hills Cop is brought to you by Ford, Pontiac, GMC, Chrysler, Chevrolet, Mercedes, and Rolls-Royce cars. They started this movie off in Detroit, so there were a lot of cars featured. Michelin tires, Flying J gas station, Pall Mall and Lucky Strike cigarettes, Michelob, Budweiser and Miller Lite beers, Webster's white bread, Crispy crackers, Frosted Flakes cereal, Cartier, Fendi, Nina Ricci, Louis Vuitton, Dunkin' Donuts, and Tab Cola, plus the possibly real or possibly fictional Gaiety Bar, Ramsey Bar, Viking Motel, Beverly Palm Hotel, WDRQ 93 FM, and the Acme Permaform Pad Company, and the Harrow Club. And this has been Sponsorship Corner.
I thought there was going to be way more.
Well, yeah, see, I noticed at the beginning that this is kind of like Blues Brothers. You remember how Blues Brothers was heavily featuring Chicago?
Yeah.
And so I'm just like, I think they were just kind of like, hey, you're going to be in the movie? Okay, sure, free advertising, right? I think that's probably what those sponsor deals are. And so things like the FM station, it was prominently displayed on one of the Detroit buses. And that whole opening bit felt very much like just like guerrilla filmmaking, like they were just grabbing shots of random people in Detroit.
Yeah. They don't do this a lot in movies, I don't feel like, anymore, but almost every 80s movie, I feel like, to set the scene, just starts with like 3 minutes of, here's all the notable sights from whatever city this is meant to take place in, to give you,
yeah,
to give you like the lay of the land. And I wonder if there's just like a... There must just be, like, some sort of stock footage that you could find. Like, there's, like, library that they just pull all this stuff from.
Oh, quite possibly. I mean, we've seen it so many times with, like, Secret of My Success shows New York. Weekend of Bernie shows New York. Like, yeah. So, yeah, he gets himself into the club with the herpes story and then confronts Victor. And then, you know, once again gets thrown out of somewhere else. And I mean, we basically get to the point where they're ready to throw him out of the city, and but he's still, you know, investigating, and so he's not actually getting thrown out of the city. Like, it's just back and forth all over the place.
Well, that's when like Rosewood comes in. Like, at what I feel like this is the point where like the chief guy comes in and is like, basically, like, you guys have mess this up so many times that now, like, you're gonna take him to the hotel, you're gonna watch him pack, and you're gonna drive him, like, to this, again, the city limits, as if there's just, like, the edge of the city where I feel like the city ends and the dark dirt road begins. But that's when, like, you know, Axel convinces Rosewood to go with him to, yeah, that warehouse.
Because the lieutenant is about to actually listen to his hunch.
Yeah.
But yeah, but the chief is like, nope, fuck this. The chief makes his appearance. They do the piss poor job of escorting him out of town. He goes back to see Jenny at one point, and he gets... Serge offers him an espresso with a lemon twist. Is that a thing?
You know, it completely passed me by when I watched the movie, but now that I think about it, I'm like, I don't know that that would be good.
Like, I could think of, like, a tea with a lemon twist, but an espresso... Like, I'm not a coffee guy, so that doesn't help.
But I am a coffee guy, and I feel, yeah, like if there was milk in that espresso, the lemon juice would make it curdle. But, I mean, I also am not a big... I'm not a lemon fan in, okay, general, so I don't know that I would like lemon in my coffee.
Okay. But
maybe it's worth trying for, yeah, the antioxidants.
And I also have to say, though, even though I'm not a coffee guy, in that scene, that is the fastest turnaround time on an espresso ever. He goes off, yeah, to get it. So they say, like, one line, and then he comes back with an espresso. No. It's, no. Espresso is not, like, not like having a pot of coffee sitting on the burner. That's not the 9 a.m. coffee that's sitting over there. That's something you gotta make fresh.
Yeah. Yeah, espresso is like the one with all the steam and the levers, right?
You would pack in you'd have the little cup that you would pack it in tightly and then screw it on and then it hisses and
yeah. Oh wow. La-di-da.
It's the little tiny cup. I don't know. And I've never been a barista. I mean, look at me being all fancy. Yeah, so because they do such a bad job of getting out Axel out of town, we end up back at the warehouse with Jenny and Billy to try to find some evidence about drugs. You know, if there were, like, no consequences, I've always wondered about rubbing cocaine on my gums. What are you tasting for? Like, I've heard there's a tingle. Like, I'm worried if I'd rub cocaine on my gums, all of a sudden I'd be a fiend for cocaine, because I know I have an addictive personality. But I've always wondered, what does it taste like?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, and why is it not, I mean, I guess it's not a full line, but it must have some sort of effect.
Yeah.
To me, it would suggest, like, maybe microdosing cocaine would be an okay thing. Not that I'm going to try it, but,
no,
like...
No. Yeah, I'm not eager. No pills, no powders. That's kind of my rule.
Yeah.
Going to the warehouse, though, I mean, you just walked into the lion's den because the bad guys catch them. Victor sends Jenny out of the situation, so they've now abducted Jenny. But Billy sees her getting into the car. I like the whole bit where it's like, stay in the car, Billy. And he does for a really long time. He is well-behaved for a long time. But he has his whole, like, internal crisis, internal conflict going on.
It is kind of odd that he would see somebody being kidnapped and still be like... Because to me, if you're seeing an actual kidnapping, then as a police officer, I feel like you now have all the grounds you need to go in. Like, the whole reason he's not going in before is because he doesn't have the jurisdiction or whatever.
Yeah.
But now you've just seen a crime in progress.
But she doesn't look like she's struggling, so does maybe he think that she's going peacefully?
I guess.
That's... Like, they've got her firmly by the arm, but she's not, like, flailing and, you know?
Yeah, that's possible.
Yeah. But, you know, Billy saves Axel, and we end up at Victor's house, and everyone reluctantly gets pulled into a giant shootout in the palatial mansion in Beverly Hills. But there's some fun stuff going on in all this action, like the whole bit with them getting over the wall and stuff like that.
So isn't there's like that massive like pile up of cars? I can't
remember. Oh yeah, yeah. It,
but yeah.
Well, the first one stops.
Yeah.
I think that was all that happened. Is the first one, or the first one got shot at, and so it slammed on its brake, and then every other one got rear-ended the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah, because for some reason in an 80s movie, we got to pile up a bunch of cop cars like we did in Blues Brothers.
Sometimes I wonder, is this movie making fun of, like, the 80s movies' cop tropes? Well, also...
No, I think this movie is the 80s movie
or,
cop tropes.
Or just, is it the cop? Because there's things like that, like, you always see in these movies where it's like, think of Blues Brothers, I guess. Like, you have all these... this massive line of police cars, like, going full blast to the scene of the big final battle.
Up a driveway. Yeah, so, full blast up a driveway.
So, yeah, it is funny, like, that just, like, one hits the brakes and then you have this massive, like, 50-car pileup. Because that's kind of what should happen in that situation.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's a lesson to them. Make sure you have to maintain a safe driving distance at all times.
Yeah. See, that's copying 101 right there. You know, that's first day driving school shit right there. So yeah, Axel ends up getting into the house and he gets to confront Zach, who comes out with a shotgun around the corner. Why wouldn't you pre-cock your shotgun? Like, he comes around the corner, he sees him squatting there, but Axel doesn't see him. And then he does the shoot, shoot. And that's what gets Axel to, like, dive out of the way. Like, why? You got to be prepared.
I had to laugh, like, Jonathan Banks has no facial emotion at all when he's shooting. He's just completely stone-faced. Like, there's no anger, no, like, sense of urgency, just lethal killing machine.
Yeah, yeah. But see, what I like about this movie, though, is we are doing the proper boss-level thing with the bad guys. And, you know, Axel takes out Jonathan Banks, and then he gets shot by Victor. And, yeah, and then we get our multi-car pileup in the driveway. But then he gets to confront Victor in the end, right? Like, I mean, there was one movie we watched recently where we were disappointed that we didn't get the boss-level thing happening with the bad guys.
But even then, it's like, well, I mean, I guess Axel gets in some shots, but it's like, it's really like the lieutenant showing up that gives Jenny the opportunity to, like, break free.
Yeah.
And then they both just waste him. And again, maybe some might call it excessive force, but I guess you have a gun pointed at you, so.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I like how after they fill Victor with holes, they decide to, you know, make sure that he falls down the stairs, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, just... Let's just make sure that, you know, just in case you didn't think he was dead, you know, that he probably broke his neck as well. You know, that's Detroit justice, motherfucker.
Axel, the one thing that's kind of odd is Axel, maybe I missed it, but I don't feel like he gets, like, his quippy line. Like, we don't get the, wipe yourself off, man, you dead. Like, we don't get that.
No, I guess not, no.
I feel like that would have been a real Eddie Murphy moment.
Yeah. If it was the Stallone version, it would have been like, this is for Mickey. And, you know, hey, yo, Mickey says hi. I don't know. That's
yo,
my
Jenny.
That's my terrible he Stallone.
He would have just been screaming Jenny at the end. And he would have been doing the whole roll shoot Mel Gibson style, like...
Yeah.
Or no, that's Point. Is that Point Break? I'm mixing them all up at this point.
I don't know. Galaxy Quest had a dive roll too at the end. So yeah, you know, the chief shows up and says, "What's this man doing here? I'm bleeding, sir." I like that line. But the lieutenant covers for Axel. You know, even though the lieutenant easily cracked the detectives earlier, he backs up Axel this time and lies for him. They're supposed to get him out of town, but they're gonna go for one drink. Axel knows the perfect place. You guys will love it, trust me. That was my terrible Eddie Murphy laugh. And the end.
What was with, is that Eddie Murphy's actual laugh?
Or is
that a character choice?
No, that's kind of him, I think. When you really hear that one, yeah. From what I know from, like, his comedy and stuff like that. Eddie Murphy backed out of Ghostbusters to do this movie. And look at that, did better at the box office. But that is Beverly Hills Cop. Now, Colin, on IMDb, it scored 7.3 out of 10 and has a Metascore of 66. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 83% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 82%. But, Colin, those are just numbers. Like a blow to the back of the head you never actually really see happen in his hallway of his apartment. Hit us with some reviews. I don't know.
All right. I think this person's name is E.I. Chong. Gives the movie 5 out of 5 stars and says, "Oh boy, did I love this film. Eddie Murphy did an amazing job as the one and only Axel Foley. I found the movie to be very entertaining. Overall, this is a very well-made and well-written movie indeed. Pretty much everything about this movie is great. I would definitely recommend this movie to those who haven't watched it yet. Trust me, you won't be disappointed one bit, especially if you're a fan of Eddie Murphy." 5 out of 5 stars.
When was that review written?
A year ago.
Oh, okay. Well, Eon found this during... COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Right on.
Jerry Flanagan says, what's cool about this movie is that all Beverly Hills, California locations in the movie were out of reach for me at an early age, even though I was born in Los Angeles. As an underprivileged child, you just never see yourself hanging out in the Beverly Hills areas at the age of 16. Once I went to college, I toured all of the film locations seen in the movie. It was a real joy to reminisce about the scenes in the movie while seeing the locations in real life. Good job, team.
Wow.
Ravi Ganta says 5 out of 5 stars. Fed up with sci-fi and superhero stuff? This movie will definitely give you some refreshment. Eddie just rocked as Axel Foley. You'll just fall in love with Axel F. and the theme named after him. You'll laugh and say to yourself that it's been so many days I laughed out this well. Just give it a try. You'll end up having fun-filled time with no regrets.
Okay. But what's funny is all these, like, even without you telling me what the date is on that one, it also sounds like it was probably a fairly recent one.
Yeah. Most of these are within 2 years.
Yeah.
Margaret Jensen says, I am an Eddie Murphy fan. I really like this movie. This movie was hilarious. Even his name in the movie was funny. Axel Foley. It's not the last name. It's the first name that makes me laugh. I just love what he did in the second movie, The Old Banana Up the Tailpipe. That was classic. I'm glad they're going to make a fourth one. I like the second one, but I really didn't like the third one about the theme park.
That's how I feel, too. Have you ever seen Clerks Uncensored? That's the Clerks cartoon that Kevin
Smith had? No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, I'll have to lend you that. Now I need to lend you Orgasmo and Clerks Uncensored. Okay. But Clerks Uncensored is, he had a... a cartoon that he only managed to make 6 episodes of before it was canceled. But there is one episode where they're put in front of a judge in court, and it's Judge Reinhold. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why he's named Judge, but whatever. But they make jokes about the banana and the tailpipe thing in that cartoon. It's pretty awesome.
Cool. Okay, this will be the last one. I feel like I might have to use, like, a Russian accent. I don't know if that's offensive to anybody, but...
exciting.
It's from
a Ukrainian accent. You're doing a Ukrainian accent.
Well, Eastern European, we'll say.
There we go.
Zbita Maludi. Okay, let's see.
I have 15 years old on communist Poland when I watched this movie first time. This was hit. People watching over and over again. There was Iron Curtain in Poland, so all people watching How Look USA. Music from this movie is popular today. Eddie Murphy and cast brilliant. I love it. I buy 3 DVD with all parts.
Love it. Love it. I think that's my favorite review reading of all time.
Yeah, the rest is all just people raving about it. Nothing really. I was trying to see if I could find any ones that were just kind of, you know, I always like to see if there's some that are just really off the wall, but
yeah.
Doesn't look like there's any for this one.
Well, the one from Poland,
that'll be good.
That was a good one. Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't find super, you know, like trashy reviews or anything like that. I mean, it's floating in the early 80s from Rotten Tomatoes, but it's much lower on IMDb. So, I mean, it seems like a fairly beloved movie. It's your first time watching it, though.
Yeah. It's pretty impressive, like, its Rotten Tomatoes score, like, it has, like, 250,000 plus reviews and is still, like, an 82% audience score. That's,
yeah,
that's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
What do I think of it? I kind of feel like it about the same way I felt about Coming to America.
I thought it was enjoyable, but I'm failing to understand the allure of Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't think it was a bad movie. I thought it was, I do think there are certain plot things, like we talked about, that it's just odd that
the main plot point happens, and then he immediately just, like, gives up any element of surprise or any element of, like, kind of the, I guess, the secretive nature of his investigation.
Yeah, a little anonymity.
Yeah. And so I thought that was weird, but I mean, there's definitely some funny moments. And I think I like you kind of said, I like Taggart and Rosewood. Once they get more involved, to me, then the movie became more interesting. Like, yeah. just the Eddie Murphy sketch stuff alone didn't really do it for me. I liked it when it was actually more part of the bigger, when Axel was actually engaging with other people as part of the bigger story.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, is this, is it an above average movie for you? Is it, you know, like, it doesn't seem like it sounds like a great movie for you. What do you think?
I feel like indifferent about it would be the best way I could put it. Like, I think I wanted to watch it, and I felt like, having known really nothing about it, like I said, the minute I found out it started in Detroit, I was like, I don't think this movie is immediately not what I thought necessarily.
Yeah.
And so I think I was expecting to feel more like Rush Hour vibes, like more, like even I would say more action. Like there wasn't as much action in this movie as I thought there was going to be.
No, like, there's a lot of storming into places and confronting people and maybe getting thrown over a table or something, but...
Yeah, like, you have the truck chase at the beginning, and you have the shootout at the end, but even the shootout is kind of, like, it's not super high stakes, it's kind of over really quick, but I thought there was going to be more, like, you know, in the meantime, where they were going to...
Yeah, but it's like, every time he gets caught, he just turns it into some sort of comedy moment, right? Like, it never in other movies, if it wasn't Eddie Murphy, like, you would have these massive shootouts and these big chases and blah 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 and all that stuff that you would normally get in an action movie, but because it's Eddie Murphy, it just turns into this, how can we bend it towards the funny rather than the action in action comedy.
Well, you know, the second one does have a bit more action. Like, you know, now that you've seen this one, are you intrigued about seeing the second one? Like, you know, if you don't want to see the third one, I get it. That's where, it, you know.
I am intrigued to watch the second one, but legitimately only because I want to know why it is that he comes back to California. Like, I thought the perfect segue at the end would have just been to, like, yeah, like, Lieutenant, you clearly like this guy. His people back in Detroit clearly don't like him. Like, yeah, move to California and stay. Like,
yeah. Yeah, like, at the end of Rush Hour, at least you see Chris Tucker getting on the plane to China.
Yeah. But I don't know. I would say, I don't know that I would give it an 80s. For me, I think it's like it's in the 60%, like a 6 out of 10.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said at the top, I like the second one better. Or it's the second one I remember more. Like, it's probably the one that I've seen more often. Out of the three, like, if we were to take only the focus group from the three Eddie Murphy movies that we have watched on this show, this, I think, is probably my favorite of them. Trading Places, I was not a big fan of. Coming to America, I liked more than you did, but... Yeah, you know, I had more fun with this Eddie Murphy than I have with any of the other ones. I mean, I got more chuckles out of this one. But yeah, I mean, for me, it's a 7 out of 10. Yeah, that's kind of where I am. It's a good movie. It still holds up, but I think I'd rather go watch the second one. So,
who am I to say anything about Eddie Murphy, I guess? But to me, knowing nothing about him, like, not having really watched any of his stuff, like, not having watched any stand-up, not watching having watched any of his SNL work, mm-hmm. when I've watched these movies, I can't help but feel like his star was hitched to those two things.
Yeah.
So it was like, I feel like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, I feel like a lot of the, like, goodwill towards his movies, I think, was hitched on goodwill that he had earned based on his performances in SNL mm-hmm. and his stand-up comedy. That, for me, having that completely removed and just trying to, like, view him objectively as an actor, I'm just like, I don't see it. There's times, like, I think, like I said, in the truck, that, like, at the beginning of the movie, I'm like, oh yeah, he's kind of funny. Like, he's funny. And it's like, you know, I appreciate, like, the wit and the fast talking and all that. But, like, as the movie goes on, I was kind of just like, yeah, I'm tired of it now.
Yeah.
Like, you have to do something more for me. Like, it can't just keep being this like, oh, I'm gonna drop into like a character. I'm gonna outsmart them with my witty funniness, or like, you know, like.
See, and maybe that's the difference, is because for me, growing up with more exposure to Eddie Murphy, I loved his comedy specials. I watched his SNL stuff. I'm Gumby, damn it, you know, Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood, all that shit. That I'm used to all his little characters, that I appreciate him from that point of view. Kind of like, yeah, you know, like, you know, for some people, you have to like the fact that Mike Myers likes doing sketch things to want to go watch a show like The Pentaverant, you know, like, yeah, you know, shit like that. I still haven't sat down and watched that one. I don't know if I want to. I have a bit more of a history with him, so I have this fondness. But the funny thing is, though, as you're talking, I know exactly what you're talking about, because that's how I am with Robin Williams, mm-hmm, right? Robin Williams is one that he sometimes funny to me. Like, I don't get it. Like, you know, I knew people that were obsessed with his stand-up comedy specials. And for me, it's like, that's just too much manic energy and too much ADD that I don't know what's going on, that I don't get it. And so, mm-hmm, I see how you can feel that way about Eddie Murphy, but I don't, you know, I have more of a nostalgia. He earned it with me, you know.
Yeah. It's not to take anything away from the movie or anything like that. It's more like something I just say like anecdotally. I don't know, when I think about the 1980s, relatively movies and filmmaking and like these big blockbuster movies were relatively new. Whereas, like, you know, our kids are going to grow up in an era where it's like every movie is this monumental blockbuster thing, and it's kind of, yeah, and it's like people didn't have to like earn their way through like the entertainment system and like years of anonymity and not know, like, everybody, like, now everybody will be from something. It's like you'll know them from TV. It's like they go TV, then they go blah, like, it's just, and so it's like Eddie Murphy, I think, will just be less and less appreciated as time goes by, and as that gets removed, and it's like people don't have time to go back and watch SNL and everything, and just know and be able to understand the entire breadth of his work that like informs his performance in this movie. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's just kind of, to me, it's just interesting in that, you know, I'm not even that much younger than you, but just from like not having access to either like TV or like a large library of movies when I was younger, or like not even, nobody I knew when I was younger was interested in SNL.
So it's like not even having that touchstone,
how much it affects me watching these Eddie Murphy movies specifically, because I hear about, like, Eddie Murphy is a legend, you know what I mean? Like, when people talk about Eddie Murphy, he's this like legendary Hollywood person, and it's just weird. Is it, maybe it's like how we would talk about like watching
Jim Carrey?
Well, not even Jim Carrey. I'm thinking like older, like even like Marlon Brando would be another one.
Okay,
like somebody older who I was just like, or like, you know, old like Clark Gable or like all these like old people who are just like,
Jimmy,
you know,
Smith.
I'm never gonna go back and watch the entirety of like somebody's film catalog from the 1940s and the 1950s because it was just so different that I'm not gonna, like, it's not gonna appeal to me. And I'm kind of getting a little bit of that with Eddie Murphy, of like, maybe it's just his comedy doesn't appeal to me that much, and I just don't appreciate, like, I'm not a sketch person really, so it's like it just doesn't appeal to me. And so, yeah, I don't know, I'm kind of just rambling at this point, but I just find it's just hard for me to sometimes watch these movies, and I can feel this like internal dissonance of like, this guy is supposed to, he's objectively a legend in this industry, but like whatever informed my brain when it comes to watching movies just doesn't see it.
Yeah, see, I mean, you know, you bring up our age difference as part of it, and, you know, that there is that, but I also have older siblings. So, so I was influenced by a brother that is 6 years older than me as well. So, you know, that's why it's like I'm really immersed in the stuff from the 70s or 80s. So, you know, like it wasn't my friends that were watching SNL. It was my older brother. So, yeah. You know, that's another place where I got those kind of influences. Yeah, you also haven't seen Eddie Murphy in any like recent, like where he's more serious, like Dreamgirls or anything like that, have you? No. Okay.
No.
Yeah. I'm just wondering. I mean, like all these actors from our youth are now doing serious things, like Adam Sandler with his new Netflix basketball movie and, you know, Uncut Gems and shit, you know.
Yeah, like it's kind of funny because really, like,
Chris Rock with Spiral.
Like Adam Sandler is what? 10 years, maybe. Like when does Billy Madison come out? 93?
94. Yeah, somewhere in there. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I would say Adam Sandler is almost like akin to like in terms of how they came up, very similar. And it's just like that 10-year difference. I love Adam Sandler. Mm-hmm. And again, I never watched any of his SNL, but it was just like whatever at the time, like Happy Gilmore and all that came out. I was just primed to enjoy that style, like his style of comedy.
Oh yeah, Waterboy and Little Nicky, big characters, right? You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, I wonder now, like, I'm sure there's people who like see Adam Sandler now and they're like, oh, like he's in that weird Uncut Gems movie or like these more serious movies, and they're like, nah, I'm not interested, like, yeah, and won't go back and
he's no Kevin Hart.
Yeah, he's no Kevin Hart.
Well, there we go. That is Beverly Hills Cop, and that's our show for this week. If you like that show, one thing you could do to really help us out is, well, just tell somebody, because word of mouth is really important to help spread word. Or you could go to whatever app you listen to your podcasts on and give us some stars. Five of them and a little review. I actually just discovered the other day how to leave stars on Spotify. I was very excited about that because they make it very discreet on there, but it is like 3 seconds of time and you can give us some stars on Spotify. Or if you want to go above and beyond and be a producer of the show, give us a couple bucks a month. It doesn't cost much, just like a cup of coffee. You could go over to patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne, become part of our Patreon family, and if you're a producer, you get a shout-out, just like Joshua Blum.
And be sure to check out our website, www.IUsedToLikeThisOne.com, for all of our social media, bios, podcast episodes, all that good stuff. And if you want to drop us a line and let us know what movies you used to like, you can email us at IUsedToLikeThisOne@gmail.com.
I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter and the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening, and join us next time when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One. Oh, maybe I should shout out my new show, too.
Yeah.
If you want to hear more from me, go check out In Front of the Yellow Line. You can follow me at In Front of the Yellow Line on Instagram or at Yellow Line Pod on Twitter. Yeah.